I need today to establish for your attention a deepening of a focus which I'm sure all of you have the focus, but almost none of you have the deepening of this particular focus. The issue is that in the center of transformation, there is a changeable, energized presence which traditionally has been objectified, and I think we'll use the Jungian term here, the Spiritus Mercurius. Mercury, the spirit of Mercury. The Hermes, the Hermetic principle, that what allows for transformation is that there is an energized, dynamic mobility in the character of a person who instigates the change, the transformation. Now, in Jung's presentation, there's a limitation. I won't say a flaw, but there's a limitation. And the limitation comes from just the limitations that Jung set himself. And it's like a man who refuses to look outside of the frame of reference that he sets for himself, even though he can, in a peripheral way, see that the activity, the lines, go outside the frame of reference. Jung's own personality was highly disciplined. He was highly scientific in a 19th century way. And he obstinately refused to let himself go outside the frame of reference. And this limitation, which has the appearance of a flaw in Jung's work, permits a very serious misunderstanding to occur in those who don't read Jung deeply, who do not have experience, profound experience for themselves, and therefore cannot tell the difference. In Alchemical Studies, on page 217, those who are dealing with this section, the Spirit Mercurius, will be glad, I think, for a little bit of help here. The section is section 5 of the Spirit Mercurius, and it's entitled The Dual Nature of Mercurius. And it reads, just in the first couple of sentences, to give us our key, Jung writes, Mercurius, following the tradition of Hermes, is many-sided, changeable, and deceitful. The emphatic word here is deceitful. He quotes an alchemist named Dorn, Walter Dorn. Dorn speaks of that inconstant Mercurius, inconstant. And another calls him Verispellus, that is, changing his skin, shifty, shape changer. He is, and then Jung puts in italics the word duplex. He is duplex. That is an alchemical term, which means that he's not simplex, nor is he complex, but he is duplex. In other words, this is a type. He is duplex, and his main characteristic is duplicity. And the duplicity, the better it works, the more that it is polarized. In other words, it's like a polarity, which when it doesn't work very well, the polarity doesn't manifest itself very well. The better it works, the more the polarity manifests itself. So that at the beginning, when the mercurial principle, that is to say, when transformation itself, Mercurius is like the conductor of transformation, when transformation begins, when that process begins, that to-be polarity also begins. That duplicity also begins. And in the first stages, very few people are refined enough to even notice. Usually what you have is an unease. You have a subconscious unease. You begin to notice that you didn't realize that this thing was here. You didn't realize that, what is that doing there? It's like that. But as that continues, as the process of transformation gains momentum, as Mercurius gains definition, the duplicity becomes more and more noticeable, and the first stage that we would characterize as intelligible, the word for that stage, oddly enough, is irony. A sense of irony comes up. You're able to see that there are, as it were, at least two distinct ways of looking at the same thing. And there's a sense that it's ironical that either of them will do. But the more that the irony grows, the wider that it becomes, the less irony is able to be appreciated as a feeling tone which you can entertain in yourself, and the more it shifts to ambiguity. And as the ambiguity becomes wider, irony, which has become ambiguity, becomes a sense of absurdity. And then there's a threshold where the absurdity becomes, for a brief calibration, becomes despair. And after that is where there is a sense of humor, laughter. Now usually what happens is that the feeling tones are so energized and we are so unconscious of their gradations that we go from irony to humor without appreciating that there are these fine graduations in between and that there is this flashpoint of despair in there. The popular image of the hysterical laughing psychotic is trapped by the consciousness that under his humor is despair. All of this is like a spectrum of increasing activity of the transformation process, tending to be objectified in the increasing definition of the figure of Hermes, of Mercury. I use the name Mercury, it's a little more affine for our purposes. Hermes is more like a teacher, and Mercury is more like this slippery instigator, trickster, if you like. Trickster figure. The objective, the purpose of that transformational process is not to keep within reasonable bounds at all that polarity. Its purpose is, in fact, to flay it wide open and make it 180 degrees opposites. But the more that one gets beyond humor, the higher levels of humor, the laughter of the gods, one says the laughter of the gods because it begins to outstrip our capacity to appreciate it, to to even understand it. So that the more that the actual polarity comes into play, the more a transcendent quality seems to come in. And it isn't our laughter anymore, but it's the laughter of the gods. That is to say, an archetypal level begins to take over rather than the personal level. And it's like the wise person will let that happen. Or the super wise will consciously then make a decision to delegate that energy, dedicate their life to that transcendent level, to God. I put my life in God's hands. You can do it that way, or you can just let it happen. Most yogis just let it happen. But for most human beings, we fight like hell not to let that happen. We would rather have the anxiety of ambiguities than have the condition of the full polarities. Now, this duplicity, this polarized aspect, is essential for transformation. Because until the opposites are indeed polarized as much as they can be, there is no transformation. One has to go fully into that wide open extent, as it were. Anything short of that, I guess we would psychologically call it adjustment. You're making adjustments. You make a deal. Who do you make a deal with? The characteristic mythological figure that you make a deal with is the devil. Well, if you'll only let me live in the world under these conditions, I'll be glad to work something out. When that tendency is raised to a typological level, you have the Dr. Faustus theme. But notice here that in the whole ecology of this activity, the goal of the transformation process is, in a very simple phrase, to be effective, to get it done, to change you. Not just to change you in an adaptive way, but to change the structure by which you operate under any adaptive covering. And in order to change the structure, you have to go through this polarization. Now, the limitation of Jung here is that it is not the spirit Mercurius who embodies this duplicity. Or rather, he embodies the duplicity, but is not the duplicity. He does not originate the duplicity. He expresses the duplicity, which belongs to another figure, a different figure. The figure that is really masterminding the polarization, masterminding the transformation, is not the spirit Mercurius, but the self, the unseen center, the unseen player, the unseen king of the fairy realm. In Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare is together enough to see him. He is Oberon. There is no Oberon in Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. There is no Oberon in Goethe's Dr. Faustus. In the Faustus theme, the reason why Mephistopheles as the spirit Mercurius can operate so well is that the devil, the Satan, who would be the Oberon, is projected out in a negative way. When the self is projected out in a negative way like this, then you have the devil. And that's the devil. Let me see, some of you, most of you are familiar with the tarot deck. When you look at the traditional iconography of the tarot deck of the devil, you notice that there is a pair of human beings there, a polarity, a man and a woman, but it expresses the polarity of the human condition. They are chained, usually, to the throne of the devil. Or there is some kind of a tie going on there. That same iconography, just turned inside out, is the lovers. Where there's an angel of presence there instead of the devil. The angel of the presence within. But if you cannot be conscious of the angel of presence within, then it's projected and exteriorized and in the world, which cannot record an angelic presence of that dimension. It's reduced down to the devil. The devil is a cardboard box version of God, if I can put it in that kind of a thing. It's that's why it's so demonic. Has all that kind of power and capacity seemingly, but can't do anything except to look for vehicles by which its activity, I use the neuter in an informed way, it's not a he or she, but an it, it's neutral, and needs us to be the mercurial agents for its transformations. They can't do anything else. And so the projected self, instead of having the transformations for you so that you grow, in a displaced way, it's the projection which grows, and the projection's activities which grow. So instead of the person growing, the projections and their activity grow. This is the very essence of evil. This is what evil is. And of course, the classic tack, which everybody knows and everybody understands, that you have to short-circuit that. Once that circuitry is set up, you have to short-circuit that. It doesn't really matter how you do it. There's no need to be tender and ginger about it. You don't have to care for the feelings of the devil. You don't have to say, well, he's going to be unemployed if I do this. This is the time to cut loose, as they say. So the whole object is a short circuit that. Now, there is a power play between two different mercurial features. Between you being the mercurial agent of your projection, and between the spirit Mercurius, who is the agent of your own transformation. And what happens, of course, inevitably, and the tradition is very clear about this, and anybody who gets into it deep enough is told point blank. If someone is trapped in this kind of a thing where they're the transformative agent of their own projections, whoever comes in to try and rectify that situation, the doctor, the teacher, the companion, they get stereotyped as the adversarial mercurial person. You're running me competition. You're trying to change me, and I'm trying to change what I'm fearing. I'm trying to be an agent and help this thing along and survive, and you're trying to upset the boat. So the doctor, the teacher, the companion at a certain stage becomes the enemy, the arch enemy, in this sense of competing mercurial figures. And of course, the I guess the hardest thing in our time is that it's so easy to walk away from a growth situation. And you get to that stage, and somebody starts to become effective, and you say, well, so long. I'll go somewhere else. I don't need this. I don't need this this tension. Or usually it comes very subtly, where you just begin to lose interest. Or you begin to think, well, that's not really important. I'll do something else. I have to wash windows today. Something like that. Notice that the sense of humor, the sense of irony, the sense of ambiguity, the sense of the absurd, all of these characteristics are not brought into play vis-a-vis your existential situation, but are transferred, as it were, to an extra-personal realm where the projected self figure now is a real negative. As long as it's projected and you give it power, it certainly exists, and exists with all the negativity that you can feed it. And most of us are very good at feeding enough negativity to scare ourselves. We know exactly where we're flawed, and we feed it energy exactly in the right way to really do the trick. It's like that. What classically short-circuits that whole thing is to bring into play one's real self. Because as the real self is evoked and brought into play, the projective capacities are lessened, and the figure of the projected negativity loses substance, loses the ability to really scare you, becomes like a mask. One can see that it certainly is terrifying and scary, but that there's nothing behind it. Or what used to be behind it is not behind it anymore, but is now somehow in you. This is a fundamental religious experience where you reclaim that power of presence within yourself and take it out of your projections. Now, you must know that the world's spiritual traditions are so refined on this matter that there are every step of the way in several dozen different ways have been enumerated. We live in a time where literally there's an encyclopedia of effective action. But all of those ways in that encyclopedia of effective action are ethnocentric. They all have a quality of having come out of the culture, the life experience of human beings in a certain way. So the curious irony in our time is that while all of the traditional ways work in their own way, none of them are able to work for us, because unless we live in some kind of a traditional way. But if you don't, if you live in the syncretistic modern world, it doesn't work. It doesn't happen. But the fact that it doesn't work and doesn't happen doesn't change the fact that the projective qualities are still going on, the transferred values are still going on, the anxieties are still happening, the polarity process is still happening. So in our time, the choice is usually a radical choice not to transform and not to even begin the transformational process, to anesthetize that quality, that aspect of human life, to pill it out of existence, or distract one permanently from the need to recognize that. And of course, contemporary technological society allows for this in spades. There are diversions as much as you would like in this world. So that in our time, there is a peculiar quality of not being able to take the first step. Because the first step reveals right away this beginning of the transformation process, where one begins to feel a little uneasy. One begins to notice that people or things or situations, those three, people, places, situations, are not quite right. Come in, honey, there's a seat over here. Now, I have written something out, and I read to you a while back, but I want to introduce it again right at this particular time, this particular moment, so that you can hear this again in a different context from the way that you heard it originally. Notice now, as long as you live below the capacity to manage your own transformation, as long as you live below that, there are powers out there that are much stronger than you. And as long as you're in that realm where the powers out there are stronger than you, then you have the realm of gods and demons and this and that. That's the mythological world. And the only parity that you have with their power is that you can make images. Images of them, images of their activity. And your image-making capacity, that is to say, your imagination, is the only parity that you have on a mythological level with the powers that are loose in the world. To human beings trapped on that level, or who live on that level and don't realize that they're trapped, they don't even realize. Many long generations of people had never even realized that they were just they were under a low ceiling, as it were. So your imagination. This is the mythological horizon. And putting it in this light, you can understand that it's no place for a modern, conscious, full human being to stay. It's a place that's essential. It is necessary. It is a place where children and young people automatically live. They must be allowed to live there. It's not a realm that one must disperse with for once and for all. There have been many powerful realizers in the human race who have been powerful enough to evaporate the mythological horizon and have painstakingly learned that it has to be reconstituted because the essential level of the universe cannot be done away with. And in its own way is a necessary kind of a nursery. But for the mature, high-powered, conscious individual, one must go through this. So this mythological horizon, here's the writing. With a mythological horizon, one lives within the language forms. You have to understand that the image base is usually put into a language. It can be a language of gesture, it can be a language of color. Usually it's a spoken language of some kind. Well, all of them together are the language of the culture. With a mythological horizon, one lives within the language forms. They're your clothing. And you can see right away the great religious metaphor that you're going to change this garment for a garment of light. You're going to change the mythological images for light. The language forms are not conscious. That is, on a mythological horizon, they are not conscious. Here, the meaning is content-oriented and feeling-toned. Content-oriented and feeling-toned. is to say, one of the major transformations that happens when that projected sense of presence comes back into you is you begin to notice the structure of things. That's how you begin to notice on the first level that something's out of place. If you could but know at the moment how sophisticated it is to understand that something is out of place, it means that you are beginning to remember an ordering. And this is out of order. It's the first turning away from being hypnotized by the content and beginning to look and penetrate through and seeing that the structure is misarranged, and therefore what has to be transformed is the structure. And the transformation happens on the structural level. Adjustment happens on the content level, but transformation happens on the structural level. If you change the content, you can have anxiety in any room in the house. But if you change the structure, the anxiety turns usually to joy. It usually turns to its polarity, which is not joy, but ebullition. Happens a lot. The Greek-Russian Orthodox mind seesaws like that, the easiest in the world, from anxiety to ebullition. It's a very curious thing. Because of the religious practices, they're very prone to that. Dostoevsky has the seesaw pendulum quality of anxiety and ebullition in his work sometimes. And the Brothers Karamazov especially, and you can get caught up in that, like he did. Incidentally, one of the cultural spin-offs from that is one becomes fascinated with gambling. One becomes interested almost in a electrocuted way with gambling, which he was, incidentally. The language forms and the mythological horizon are not conscious. Here the meaning is content-oriented and feeling-tone. Now when you shift from looking at the content, like the habitual thing, as if I look at this desk and I see books and I see tape recorders and I see photos and I see papers, that's content-oriented. If I look structurally, I see the array in this pattern. This pattern discloses a different kind of meaning from an inventory of the content. So that when I shift to structure from content, I also shift from feeling image base to thought toned. So that structural attentiveness has a thinking tone quality. Different. So here the meaning in the mythological horizon is content oriented and feeling toned. Interiorized meaning focuses into the symbolic vision. Now the symbolic vision is the meeting where content and structure, where feeling and thought come together, the inner self. That symbolic self, the symbolic self, is even called that. Here, the forms of language are conscious. That is to say, they may not immediately be conscious for you, but you can, in your own way, discover that they are, in fact, conscious. So that they're able to be discovered to be conscious there. Here, the forms of language are conscious and one is abstracted. I've got that in quotation marks. One is abstracted, taken out, seeing, but seeing in a different way, seeing in a structured way. The most sophisticated writer I have run across who understood this process and was able to do it and to talk about it is the great artist Wassily Kandinsky. Kandinsky is masterful at being able to say what the abstraction process is and to show how it works. And in fact, the development of abstract art owes a lot of itself to Kandinsky. You might have seen, when was it, last year or 2 years ago, when they had the big show of the spiritual and modern art. All that is an amplified resonance of Kandinsky's work. Certainly a lot of Mr. Hall's sacred material, illustrations were in that show. Why is that spiritual? It's spiritual because to be conscious of the abstraction process is to be conscious of the deep self and the way it works. And as one does that more and more, that consciousness is presented in your own person, in your own life, and the projections, whatever projections you have, lose their tenacity. Become again, in fact, mask-like. I don't want to get you strung out too much, but it's like a regression happens. Instead of you regressing, your projections regress. And where do they regress back to? They regress back to the ritual level. What has powered them is a mythological level. And when the symbolic self comes into focus in you, your projections lose and regress back to the next stable level, which is the mask. It's like that. It's like a seesaw. Whereas if you would lose presence, if you would lose confidence, if you would lose the courage, then your projection would change. And you would regress back to a mask-like ritual of figures held by their own compulsion. Notice that the fulcrum of this whole balance, self and ritual, interior spirit and projection, that the fulcrum of this whole seesaw is the mythological horizon. You can see how important it is, but you can see also that myth is not an objective to get to and stay there. This is an error of justification. It is a crucial fulcrum. But the cruciality of the fulcrum is that one is able to extract a presence out of that, away from that, that you are able to come to. The more that one is able to do that, the more that the self has presence, the more that you can see structurally, the more that you can think, your language changes from a mythological horizon to the traditional saying, the magical horizon. You realize that what you say works. When a mathematician goes through his series of equations, he knows that this language can be made to work in this world. So the abstraction does not mean that it's abstracted from efficacy, but it's abstracted to a capacity to be even more efficacious. But notice how the projected self twists it around and turns it around and says, well, you want to be abstracted, do you? You don't want to be just mechanical. And so the characterizing of science as purely mechanical is the devil's own kind of language. It's a perfect example. And incidentally, it's happened in the last 300 or 400 years many times that the scientific capacity has been stymied on this kind of a negative
almost an evil religious ploy. In fact, the more one gets caught into that, the more difficult it is, because it seems to have ramifications beyond oneself. I can't have very much to do about this. But in fact, the central player always is yourself. The central player is yourself. And that if you are able to transform, in fact then, the world has been transformed. As soon as anyone is free, all are helped by this. That happens to be a principle. The traditional homily was that in total darkness, if you light one candle, it goes a long way. I mean, if you've ever been in a cave where there's total darkness, lack of natural light, if you light one match, it's just so bright, you can hardly bear to look at the glowing phosphorus of the match until it burns down. It's like that kind of a principle. We are all interrelated in our psychic energy in such a way that anyone becoming free helps all of us. So here, that is to say, in the symbolic self, the forms of language are conscious, and one is abstracted or transcended from the feeling tone content somewhat. Deepen the integration and lessen the feeling content, the more the tranquility of the deep self, and the more that the quality of imageless or imagelessness occurs. Now, for people first coming into this, it's like carrying over bad habits. Where you used to be content-oriented, now you become tranquility-oriented. And you love just to be quiet and imageless. It's such a relief not to have the images compelling you. And so it's very nice to turn off all the machines, to turn off all of the energies, and just be. This is due to being green, to being a dude, to being naive. And you can't blame anybody for wanting to take a rest for two or three eternities after the struggle to get through. But the fact is that that is misunderstanding the situation. Because in the deep self, in the symbolic vision, all of that meaning is constantly coming to a focus. All of that dynamic is there. And though you can balance it in high moments, it tends to want to slide back, regress back, so that one then becomes addicted to the ascetic practices of maintaining the tranquility. And for long, long ages, most of the traditions that I would be a spokesman for were immersed and mirrored in this. In powerful ascetic practices to simply snatch up any psychological or any bodily intrusion into the tranquility, and with deft psychic surgery, take its wings off, take its legs off, take its horns off, and drop it into nothing. This is a serious error. For one thing, the world is not helped by such individuals. And the world condition in general gets worse and worse and worse. Because the best those human beings are capable of helping others are spending full time in keeping themselves abstracted. This is a serious situation. It was, and it's come to an end, come to a close. If you put it in a word, the ascetics have to go back into town and go to work. the vacation is over. The image exists in language. The image exists in language. So that if one is looking for the effective grammar, one has to consult the arrangement of the image base. If you want to understand someone, you want to find out what their image base is. It used to be put in a kind of a grandiose philosophic way. If you want to understand the people, you have to understand.